It's only May, but 2010 is already turning out to be the best year ever for composer Jennifer Higdon. She just won the Pulitzer Prize in Music for her violin concerto, right after winning a Grammy Award for a percussion concerto. Higdon is a rarity, a serious composer whose work is performed a lot. This month alone, Higdon pieces will be played by orchestras in Des Moines, Grand Forks, Kansas City, West Hartford, Dallas, and I could go on. Jennifer Higdon joins me here today. Welcome to Studio 360, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's listen to a clip of your violin concerto that just won the Pulitzer Prize. This is the third movement, Flying Forward, and it's performed by Hilary Hahn. That is from Jennifer Higdon's violin concerto. Are you conscious of, I want to write a piece of music that is identifiably from now and couldn't be earlier? Or how does that figure into what you write?
Well, you know, I never stop to think if something is identifiably American or classical. In this particular piece, when I was writing it, I was thinking about Hilary Hahn. I was writing it for her, so I was thinking, what can she do? What does she sound good doing? And I try to make the adjustments according to the artist for whom I'm writing. I'm very lucky that I always know who's going to be doing the work.
Right.
And so I don't think about the language, though. It's just the noise that comes out of my head. I just have to figure out how to organize the noise, and hopefully it all makes sense.
So when you write for one musician, what does that mean specifically? What do you do differently or don't do that if you were writing for someone else?
Well, for Hilary, she made the announcement early on that she wanted a 30-minute piece, something really massive, and I thought, ooh, that's a lot of music. Then the thing becomes just daydreaming. What can you do that would be interesting? I think of two things. What fits the performer? Hilary can play fast. She can make giant leaps in the left hand. She plays intervals that are kind of unreal, and she also has a beautiful sound, low down, high up, and so each of the movements kind of emphasize that. That last one moves pretty quickly. The first movement actually has like leaps all over the place. They're very, really unviolinistic, but Hilary made it sound kind of easy.
Yeah.
And so it's just a matter of trying to capture her personality. I've known Hilary a long time, probably about 12, 13 years. I had her as a student at Curtis. She came into my 20th century music class, and it was kind of an amazing experience the very first day. She probably doesn't remember this. She came up to me and she says, you know, I don't really like new music. And I said, that's okay. We got a year to work on that. So I think I got to convince.
Well, there's somebody who's a musician, a young, brilliantly talented musician who says she doesn't think she likes new music. And just listeners, people who go to concerts, there's still this stereotype of, oh, any all that stuff from the 20th century. It's just, it's too dissonant. It's too difficult. Is that a problem that people like you are still dealing with?
That's a good question. I get asked this a lot, but the thing is I get a lot of performances with orchestras. I do encounter this sort of fear. And so I think part of my job is actually to go to wherever that piece is being done with an orchestra and talk to people, try to kind of break down the fear, talk to them about what makes a contemporary piece. If they don't like one piece, they might like another. And when I look at their programs, there actually is more new music on them.
I read that you didn't even start playing music until you were in your teens. How did that happen, and how did you start so late and go on to become a composer?
Well, I started playing because there was a flute laying around the house. My mom had gotten some cheap flute, actually like a no-brand name from a pawn shop. She'd picked up a beginning band method book, and I don't know that she ever really played with the instrument or anything, but one day I just picked it up. I was about 15 years old, And somewhere along the line, I got the crazy idea I wanted to major in music, even though I didn't really know any classical music. It was tough, to be quite honest, because I was always behind. I didn't know repertoire. But I think the cool thing was I was totally into practicing, which is not exactly normal.
Yikes. Yes, exactly, which is exactly what you don't want to do at 10 and 11 when my parents were trying to force me to practice.
Nope. There was hardly any classical music in my household. It was a creative household. My dad's a commercial artist, and during the 60s and 70s, he did a lot of freelance art. So my brother and I, when we were very young, started going to art happenings. So there was creativity galore, just none of it was classical music. The music in our household was all 60s rock, folk.
So you were just a normal hippie kid, basically.
Or totally.
Yeah?
Yeah, totally.
Did your parents take you to these happenings?
Yes, I actually remember one in particular where this one gentleman who was an art student in Atlanta had strapped himself to a black painted canvas, and he had on a black shirt, and he had this idea that while this really odd music was running, he was going to stand in front of a fan. He'd put glue all over the front of his shirt and the canvas, and they would blow white feathers into the fan so that the feathers would stick on him, and suddenly, in the dark, he would become visible as the feathers were sticking. But he didn't think about the fact that glue can make you very high, and so he put the rubber cement on, and within about 2 or 3 seconds, he passed out, but he was strapped to the canvas, so it made quite a sound when he hit the stage.
And you
actually
were
kind of comical.
And how old were you at this time?
I think I was about six or seven.
And he probably thought he was releasing the inner child, and here you were a child thinking, what the heck is going on here?
That's a good description, exactly.
Did that affect the way you regarded the avant-garde in music?
My dad and I used to have this ongoing argument when I was a teenager. He used to talk about how John Cage's music, any kind of sound, and I was always saying, Dad, that's not true. You got to organize the sound. Now I understand what my dad was saying, but at the time I was like, it's too unstructured. I need more structure. And I have no doubt that's connected to my childhood and all the art happenings and the experimental films that were being made by art students. We had them coming through our house all the time. So it was a fascinating learning experience and very different than what one would expect from a classical musician.
So you get all these commissions. You've always got your work table is full. How do you proceed? How do you go from blank lined paper to a piece of music?
The first couple of weeks when you're writing a piece, when it's blank page in front of you, is a complete nightmare because you're trying to find a sound world. Getting it started is just agony. But what happens is I start coming up with musical ideas that sound like they might be interesting themes that would fit the instrument or the concept of the piece. And so then I try to figure out what's the architecture, what's the design of the piece. And sometimes I use graph paper. It'll make little, looks like a cardiogram. The music needs to go up. It goes down. It kind of, you think about where all the high points are going to be. But slowly you piece together these ideas. You figure out how to get them to develop. There's a lot of daydreaming. You get all these notes down. And the next thing you know, you're sending the music off. There's like 40,000 notes on the page. I always have the computer count this up because it's a fascinating fact to give the audience. Always causes an audible gasp. It's as if I were building a house with blinders on and I'm putting down the bricks one at a time and you hope that they all line up, they all match. Then when you step back, you take the blinders off, the whole house is there. You're like, wow, that's really big.
That's Blue Cathedral by Jennifer Higdon. There's that lovely interplay between the flute and the clarinet. You began, you say, as a flautist, yeah?
That's right, absolutely. And that piece was written for my brother, Andrew Blue, after he passed away, and he was a clarinetist, so it was nice to have kind of the interaction, the dialogue between the two instruments there.
Does it make you sad to hear it, given the genesis?
Occasionally in live performances, I get choked up. You know what really moves me are the people who come up afterwards who are very emotional. Some of them so emotional they can't speak. They just take your hand. They're very teared up. And I know exactly what they're saying. A lot of times they'll say, oh, I lost someone. In that way, I always think to myself, wow, this is like the best experience of music. If you can move people to that degree, you're doing something right. So I'm somehow, to me, it's a very personal piece, but it's also thrilling that that's the piece I wrote for my brother Andy. And it's been done a lot. I mean, over 250 orchestras and still going strong. So it's fun to be able to share that work, actually.
Jennifer, thank you very much for being with me today.
You're quite welcome.
Jennifer Higdon is the winner of the 2010 Pulitzer Prize in Music. Her prize-winning violin concerto will be released in September. You can find out dates for the performances of her music at studio360.org.